My name is Spencer Sunshine. I have a doctorate in sociology, and I've been researching, writing about, and doing counter-organizing against the U.S. far right for about 15 years.
Well, Spencer, welcome to Shitpost, the podcast about a lot of stuff. But I'm having you on now because you produce this excellent guide. It's called 40 Ways to Fight Fascist, Street Legal Tactics for Community Activists. I'll put a link to it in the description so everybody can go check it out. I think this is very timely, especially as, this summer we have seen tensions between, anti-fascist street demonstrators and far-right groups kind of boil over. We have seen, the president is speaking, saying, Antifa is a domestic terror organization, yada, yada, yada. It's like one of the big tactics of the election this year seems to be trying to make everything Antifa, which is a bit ridiculous if you have, I think, a general understanding of the political landscape. But, I think this guide comes at a perfect time. Can you talk a little bit about what got you thinking about producing this guide and, how you hope it can be useful?
The guide has a bit of a funny history. After Charlottesville, we really felt like there was a dire need for people to be taking grassroots action against far-right organizing. There were very few people who were doing it. It was largely limited to self-identified Antifa activists, and we really needed a much larger swath of people to do this work. A lot of people didn't understand that almost all this work is legal and that there are physical conflicts in the streets, but you can do this work without, using those tactics. I worked with a group like this when I was a teenager called Neighbors Network in Atlanta, Georgia. And so I was trying to inspire people to who hadn't been involved, who maybe were turned off by the veneer of violence, wanted to do something, but there was this whole discussion about, oh, is it okay to punch a Nazi, and being like, this is really a red herring. There's all kinds of things you can do, effective tactics and necessary organizing work without getting into any of that. So it actually came out in 2018. It was originally released by Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice. There were a lot of problems with it. And Pop Mob, a group in Portland, Oregon, that's helped mobilize people to the demonstrations out there, was still distributing old copies of it. And I said, "Hey, I want to re-release it. I don't like the old one looks. And there's, we wanted to update the language and all kinds of stuff." So I worked with them, and they said, "Oh, I had designed the guide for Nazis and white nationalists, and it's based on a lot of things that have been developed in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of it, in O's is about, most people in even conservative communities don't want, or at least maybe before the last few years, didn't want outright white supremacists, especially who are engaging in violence. And so a lot of this stuff is about how to socially isolate people in bigger communities." Pop Mom was like, we've been able to use these tactics against other groups that are a little more moderate, but generally they use violence, like the Proud Boys and certain militias. If people have guns or use violence, you can still use these tactics. So we joined forces to re-release this. I was a little not sure if people were going to be into it because it was in a sense about an earlier time, but there's been such an amazing reception. There clearly is a hunger for this kind of stuff. It's clear that people don't have this knowledge, even though it's pretty basic stuff. I think sometimes when you've been an activist a long time, you forget that everyone doesn't know what you know. It's being translated into other languages. It's gotten thousands and thousands of shares on social media, and people seem really into it.
So diving straight in, I think it would be hard to listen to if we went through all 40 of the points. So I will save listeners that. And like I said earlier, I'll put a link to this on Spencer's website. You can go check it out and read the full thing for yourself. But you've kind of broken it up into sections. And I think maybe talking about the sections would be the most helpful thing here. So the first section of your guide is all about sort of getting started and keeping a lay of the land. So if people are concerned about what they're seeing with far-right organizing or far-right political movements seeming to rise up in national prominence, you know, if they have no experience paying attention to this stuff or looking for it in their own communities and that sort of thing, you know, what are sort of the first things they can do?
Sure. I often, when I talk to people, the first thing I want to do is for progressives is dispel what I call the big black box, where people to them, the right is everything from like George Bush to neo-Nazis, and they really don't understand the difference. So in the guide, the first thing is we encourage people to learn more about the far right, to go to, you know, various web pages like Right Wing Watch and other other pages.
Appreciate
that. to learn about to learn more about these groups, and then to get them so that people get a general lay of the land and start seeing them as, you know, the subtrends they are. Just like for progressives, you know, people understand there's a difference between communists and anarchists and democratic socialists and environmentalists. Like the right also is divided up into different factions, and sometimes they get along and don't. And then encourage people to start watching the local groups that are in their area, because that's what we want to encourage people to do. There's national groups that pay attention to things, but it's important that everyone of these national groups can't pay attention to everything that's happening in your community. And if you have that organizing there, if people are attacking others, you know, spewing vitriolic, you know, racist and bigoted, talking points and propaganda, it's important that you and your community take notice of this, figure out who these actors are, and start watching them.
So
should I go through? I can go through all the sections if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah, let's dive right in. So somebody's familiarized themselves with these movements, understanding that, you know, maybe not everyone in a MAGA hat is like wanting genocide on a mass level and stuff like that. You know, kind of understanding some nuances, what you call kind of the black box. Then what? What do they do next?
Well, the first thing in the second section, I give a number of things they can do to push back against these groups. For example, they can try to get them if they are holding meetings or events that require permits, to try to get those things to be squashed. We've had a lot of success if groups are like meeting in bars or other venues, of getting the venues themselves to remove them from it, to not allow them to meet. Of course, you can push public officials not to give permits to things. This was a big argument before Charlottesville, was about how to be a permitted march, and eventually they did get their permit. So another thing we encourage people to do, if the far right groups are putting propaganda up in public, to take it down and ideally replace it with anti-racist and anti-fascist propaganda. Patriot Front, who are now the biggest, I think, younger alt-right white nationalist group, are really emphasized putting propaganda up in neighborhoods, and some neighborhoods are hit again and again. So we encourage people to go out, remove all this stuff, and replace it with counter messaging. And one of the more well-known, although sometimes controversial, tactics are to when people are white supremacists or are violent far-right groups, to expose them in their neighborhoods and their workplaces. You can tell their neighbors, you can put up flyers about them, you can call into their work and you know, ask that they be fired. You know, some places are more sympathetic than others, but generally, if somebody's, you know, advocating genocide and they're in a public position, or they're, you know, espousing open racism and they're dealing with a, you know, multiracial clients, most companies don't want that. So we try to create, I mean, these are all legal things. These are all nonviolent things. These are not necessarily things that people think of as activism every day, but these are all kinds of legal things that people can do. And this is the proactive ways that, outside of demonstrations and stuff, you can push back against far-right organizing.
So you mentioned being proactive. That's the title of the third section. You know, why is it important to be proactive against far right violent organizing? I think, you know, especially after Unite the Right happened in 2017, there was a lot of kind of the sense of like people were reacting to what seemed like a brand new threat, or, you know, to people who hadn't been doing the work for years, was, you know, they were like, where did this come from? What's going on? We have to push back against this. Speaking in the broadest strokes here, why is it important to be proactive against these various political forces instead of maybe reactive?
Well, there's two reasons. One, we don't want to let them set the agenda if they come into a neutral situation with their talking points first and already having organization. It's much easier for them to win the high ground. And the second is sometimes it takes a while to get a lot of things that are necessary set up. And if you wait till they've started acting in your community and you're going to need some certain structures, you know, you're going to be way behind. You know, if they're set up in advance, then you're on a much better space. So it's good to – there's things to do in advance, and some of these things make it harder for them also to – for their ideas to take root and for their organizing to take root. I mean, we've seen in many places groups often come in with a bit more of a soft sell, you know, into a community that's not expecting them, and that allows them to really gain a foothold. So some of the things that I recommend – three things I recommend people to do. I really like this. Not that many people do it, but I like memorial events. You can hold processions or vigils or other things in places where people have been killed by the far right, places where there's white nationalists and other genocidal atrocities. After Charlottesville, I went to Portland, Oregon, and we laid a wreath on the grave of Mulugeta Sarah, who was an Ethiopian immigrant who was killed by Nazi skinheads in the late 80s. So we, I got a dozen people, and we went to his gravesite and laid a wreath and read a little something. So you can do these in communities, so communities are aware before there's far-right organizing about what the implications of this are going to be. I think a lot of people don't realize how violent the far-right is. And when you show the past, what white nationalism has looked like in that community, in the physical spaces, on which street corners – I used to live two blocks from where Sarah was killed. I think this sort of – preps people to not be so sympathetic to it when it comes in. And then some things that it's better to do beforehand than after are establishing an emergency response team and doing fundraising. Fundraising, all political movements need fundraising. If you've never done fundraising before, there's some tricks to it, and it might take you a little bit to figure out how to do it. It's always better to have money in your pocket when you need it rather than scramble for it later. I can't tell you how many times people have called me and been like, somebody's gone to the emergency room and they don't have insurance. You know, do you have money? And I was like, well, we have raised money in advance, you know, rather than trying to do it afterwards. It can really jam up your organizing. And developing an emergency response team is really important. You know, if there's far-right organizing in your community, there's going to be emergencies. This may be fights. It may be people being injured. It may be surprise demonstrations. This isn't — again, these are all legal things to do. This isn't saying, oh, this is like, you know, I'm not saying organize an A-team, but like organize like a medic and, you know, somebody who can do communications and people who are ready to go out, you know, on a moment's notice if there's an emergency, you know, set up a way to be contacted and a way to mobilize people. This has been a big problem for years and years.
Right, right. If a lot of far-right organizing that's been popular during the last couple of years that I've seen, at least, has been these kind of flash demonstrations or these very rogue acts of violence that just seem to show up, you know, where a group will just sort of like swarm a bar where they think a bunch of anti-fascist organizers are or something like that. So next section, we've got two more, so we can just bang out to the end of this and then open it up. Counter demonstrations. So counter demonstrations are where a lot of the kind of anti-nos of the world or whatnot will go, and they'll film people dressed in all black and, you know, seek to portray them as these violent threats to just, you know, red-blooded American people, when oftentimes, you know, for whatever reason or using whatever tactics, you know, these videos are coming off the ground in places where extreme groups with tendencies for violence and you know, deep community harm are organizing. You know, street legal tactics for counter demonstrating that aren't, I don't know, throwing a bottle or something. I'm trying to like think of the last like Antifa scare porn video I saw.
So Andy No, I think yesterday or the day before, tweeted out a picture of some mutual aid being refugee aid being given away in Portland with a copy of the 40 Ways Guide. So I want to thank Andy for the free propaganda. He's attacked me in the past by recycling information from a white nationalist website. So it's always good to get name checked by him. So yeah, I mean, it's just information about how to organize basic counter demos, especially at this point in the game. I think people should consider if whether they want to hold them or not. You know, 4 years ago, the evolution of these demonstrations and counter demonstrations has been very strange. Like 4 years ago, they were designed for white supremacists, and now the sort of constant back and forth has gone from white supremacists to people adjacent to white supremacists, like Patriot Prayer and stuff, and now to groups that have very few, if any, ties to them, but are otherwise, you know, Trumpist kind of groups. So if you decide to call a demonstration, if you've never organized one before, especially a bigger one, they require a lot of work. This is actually a time that a lot of people, one of the things in the guide we do stress is that not everything in here, but most of the things can be done by people from all different kinds of identities and skill levels. And, you know, physical abilities, like, and so a lot of stuff for demonstrations doesn't involve ever getting out on the street, organizing housing, doing publicity, setting your coalition up, you know, fundraising again, you know, what are you going to, how are you going to take care of people afterwards? How are you going to interface with the city or other things? So it just sort of steps, you know, walks people through what are the different parts of organizing a demonstration and where can different people plug into it? Because this is especially a way that people can plug into, and they don't even need to get in the street to do a lot of the, it's a lot of work, and you don't even need to get in the street to do that work.
So last section, be supportive. And I think this is something that could be worth underscoring among, you know, I have a different perspective as somebody who approaches this as a reporter. But when I've covered demonstrations or I've spoken to, you know, anti-racist, anti-fascist, you know, researchers, organizers, a complaint that I have heard, you know, voiced to me several times is that, you know, sometimes it feels like you're just kind of suspended out in the middle of nowhere. You know, something awful will happen, whether it's digital harassment, threats, et cetera. And, you know, there's not exactly all the time a huge safety net to fall back on. So it seems that, like, this section seems to kind of go into kind of how to set that up and be ready for, you know, if you're trying to disrupt far-right organizing, eventually they will, like, try to push back on you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they'll try to do this almost immediately to you. So, yeah, we stress, and we've always stressed that this is, you know, this work isn't just they do a thing and we react. You should have a long-term view of it. And so part of that is supporting other people. And it's very important. Like, you're going to want support. If you take an action and there's blowback, you will want support. And a lot of people come to demonstrations, especially who are more in the periphery of activist stuff. You know, they come to an angry demonstration and they go home and they don't do anything until the next one. And there's a lot of work in between times to help other people. So one of the things that we feel is very important is that when the far right recruits, they often, and this is perhaps more true of fascists, you know, they often recruit from certain communities, certain religious communities, certain music or subcultural communities, some very niche things. And this always creates a pushback from within them. And the people who push back often feel outnumbered. This is a pretty common thing. And sometimes it takes them years to try to gain the upper hand or isolate the other people. And sometimes it's an ongoing battle that goes on for decades. I mean, famously in the punk rock scene, there's Nazi skinheads. There have been Nazis in the punk scene since the 1970s. It's just like an endless battle that has to, it's almost like a fire that constantly has to be tended. this has been an issue for many years in the heathen scene. This is the Northern European, Germanic, Scandinavian form of paganism, of which white nationalists basically gained the upper hand within the heathens. And it's been a rearguard battle of anti-racist heathens to force them out. And so we often say the best people to push back, especially in these rather niche things, are people who are the actual participants in them. Like, there's anti-fascist Satanists. And if you're not a Satanist, it's going to be very difficult for you to come and criticize something in the Satanist community and have any legitimacy. You're really going to want people who are inside of that community to do this pushback. So we encourage people to find the people inside of communities that are pushing back against white nationalists and other kinds of far-right recruiting and help them out, because often they feel outnumbered and that they need whatever basic support they need. Other things involve people who are being targeted for harassment or violence by the far right, because this is really their calling card. And this is a calling card from the militias to the Nazis. They all do it, whether it's with guns or fists or knives or brass knuckles. So one thing that people can do, and again, this is something anybody can do, is establish a safe house. And this sounds really scary, but it's basically just somebody who's generally not known. Not known to the far right, maybe not known to progressive activists, who has a place that people can go to and crash out at if they need to escape, or they are. If people are threatening them at their home, if they've been doxxed, people are coming by their house and throwing stuff at them or taking shots at them, somewhere that they can go to on a moment's notice. So this, anybody could do this if they have a spare room or even a couch. Some of this is supporting people who are being threatened. If you've, I mean, I'm sure you've been threatened, Jared. I've gone through periods of just like, being hammered with death threats. Even when it's not a physical thing, it can be very unnerving. So to support people who are being threatened, again, in whatever way they need at that time, sometimes you have to hurriedly sort of scrub things. I cannot tell you how many times I've taught people how to prepare their residence, to secure their residence, talk them through what happens if there's a home invasion, just basic stuff like, well, what's your plan if there's a home invasion? I had a friend who's a professor in some small town in Texas who became the Antifa symbol in his town because he had like an Antifa logo on his Facebook, profile, something. And then he just got hundreds and hundreds of threats and people are coming by his house. So, support people are being threatened, support people who've been injured. A lot of people get injured by the far right, the far right's killed hundreds and hundreds of people in the last few decades in the U.S. alone. I think the number's over 450. It's probably around 500 now since 1990. So support the families of people who are killed. Not just are thousands of people injured. When people die, their families need help with the funeral expenses. I've helped fundraise for funeral expenses. And then the families need support. It's like when people go to jail, we understand this affects their family and the bigger community. I think this has become a more common understanding. The same thing happens when someone's killed. Like it creates often a crisis in their family, and it creates tension in the whole community. I mean, this is why the hate crimes are useful, quote unquote, to white supremacists. If they kill one black person, it creates fear in that whole community there. So, work with the families of people who've been killed. And then sometimes people go to jail, and we encourage people to support prisoners. All political movements end up with, almost without exception, end up with people in prison. You don't have to agree with everything that person's done. It's not an endorsement of their actions. But, it's terrible to be in prisons in the U.S. Being a prisoner is very expensive. It can easily cost like $10,000 a year to give them commissary if their family needs to travel to visit them, to pay for phone calls. Like, the prisons bleed the prisoners for money. It can be very expensive, and the families need assistance with this. And prisoners don't want to be forgotten. Some of this can be just as simple as writing somebody, once a month, and it really gives them a sense of connection and helps them through the process.
So we've gone through the basics of this guide. There's 40 points. Spencer, you get into the specifics of each point, explain them a little bit more. Like I said, I'll have a link to this in the description of the show. Go check it out if you're interested. Spencer, I want to hear, you said you wrote the first version of this in 2018. You said, you re-released it with Pop Mob, and it's got a good reception so far. Have you felt that there was kind of a hunger for something like this? Are you surprised that it's been so well received?
I am surprised. I wasn't really sure what people were going to think of it. There clearly is a real hunger. I think I finally decided that often for activists, there's something that it's funny. James Mason calls this the 18-month syndrome. I think with leftists, there's it's a 24-month syndrome. People get really involved for about 2 years, and then they get burned out. I mean, long-term political people are different. So I feel like, well, maybe the people who saw it the first time around have already left, and there's a new wave of people. But clearly, many, many people were very interested in this information, hadn't been exposed to it before. People in other countries needed this kind of thing because some of it's very U.S. specific. Like, gun laws are very different in the U.S. than in Western Europe. It really also struck me how much people wanted something to do. Like, people are really afraid about what's going on. They see that there's nationwide violent far-right organizing. Of course, the situation with the election is incredibly tense. Many expectations that Trump won't step down, even if he loses the election. And they want to do something. And so I think people really, this does provide things that anybody can do. I mean, anybody can do at least some of these things. You can do many of these things from your home, especially with digital everything. You can do most of these things from your home. But many things you can do for your home. And I think people are really, there's a hunger for this sort of, to want to know a way to plug in without being a super specialist.
Right. And, you know, the everyday person who, you know, is not, you know, somebody like me reporting on it, somebody like yourself who's been, working in this space for quite some time, you know, can you speak more to why you think it's important for, you know, people down at the granular level, or, you know, people who would maybe consider themselves less political, to, you know, what kind of benefits could come from having this kind of mindset and this kind of organizing spreading in numbers?
I believe that the only way if there's far right organizing in your community, the only way that that's going to be stopped is by grassroots action from members of your community, or at least until it's too late. You know, in Charlottesville, people don't remember this. It still angers me. The only groups that called people to a counter protest in Charlottesville was a local surge group, Charlottesville Black Lives Matter, and then anti-fascist groups. No national nonprofits called for this. The big groups like the ADL and the SPLC told people to stay away. And I think that would have been a terrible thing. If nobody had shown up to counter protest, they would have had a hugely successful rally and used it as a stepping stone to other things. Nobody could have predicted what happened with the car attack. If you wait for other people, if you wait for law enforcement, well, law enforcement may or may not ever step in. It took the FBI many years. It took until the El Paso massacre for them to decide to crack down on the openly pro-terror, you know, neo-Nazi networks around Adam Waffen and the other ones. Like, they really just let those networks, you know, be active in plain sight for many years, and we're just like, whatever. We can write about this stuff, but writing about stuff is important and it's necessary, but as it said, it's necessary but not sufficient. These things have to be acted on, especially if there's violence in your community. It's not going to be, I believe, with far-right groups, and I've seen this over many years, starting with Nazi skinheads in the late 80s and early 90s, that it's only going to be stopped if the community puts a stop to it, or it's going to go on for years before they do anything. I mean, look at law enforcement out in Oregon. They're claiming that Antifa is starting the forest fires. Do you think that they're really going to stop a militia group that's going around threatening people? Like, they're probably in bed with them.
Right. And, you know, you touched on it already a little bit. It's very easy to, you know, there's national groups that do this kind of work. As a reporter based in Washington, I'm often trying to understand things from maybe broader national implications, but this kind of organizing is taking place, all over the place, kind of in plain sight sometimes. People who know me or people who have listened to the show for a while will know sometimes I talk about growing up in Arkansas, which still has active KKK cells in it, and not a KKK cell in the term of, you know, I think according.
Oh, are you from Harrison?
It was like an hour and a half away from where I grew up. So I every once in a while I would see the photos of the billboards there going around, and people would be like, "This must be photoshopped." And I'd be like, "No, it's sorry to report, it's not." You know, and they cause a lot of trouble all around the state. You know, disrupting Holocaust Day Holocaust Remembrance Day events.
Billy.
Yeah, Billy. Oh man, what a that could be a whole nother episode. It's just Billy, but
should have a National Alliance alumni episode.
I know, but the point is, like, this is kind of happening in a lot of places, and you know, you mentioned earlier these national groups don't have, you know, maybe the resources or just the raw numbers it would take of people to be able to track all of this. So, you know, do you think that there is an advantage for people to try to, you know, research this and identify this in their own communities versus maybe trying to contribute to a national scale? Or I'm curious what you think in this present moment would be more helpful to the broader cause of anti-racism or anti-fascism.
Well, I mean, I feel like there's good national work being done. I mean, there's tons of organizations and writers and researchers on the national level, but nobody can track all the intricacies of your local organizing. You know, that's going to have to be done locally. And one of the main things that the main reason I wrote this guide, and I still feel that it's very relevant, is that though there are these national groups, and some of them do very admirable work in tracking and talking about these groups, nobody is encouraging local grassroots groups to do counter-organizing. There are no national nonprofits, the ones who would have the resources to do this, which is why there's a large Antifa movement now, because it's only people who do the organizing under the Antifa label that do it nationally. Like, where's the network? And there was a network, loosely. There were groups. It wasn't quite a national network. There were groups like this in the 80s and 90s across the nation that established themselves. So the national groups, the local groups, and then it was ARA, basically Antifa groups. And there aren't now. There hasn't been in this period, and I find it very strange. I dislike it that the nonprofits haven't done this. I mean, I think the national groups do good work at what it is, but I think there needs to be more hands-on kind of stuff, because people in your community are going to need to take care of your community. You know, we saw this. I did a lot of work about the militias in Oregon starting in 2015. It was actually the year before the Bundy family took over the Malheur Refuge. I was working on a project. It came out later, and we found out that Oregon was honeycombed with militia organizing, that they had made inroads into county governments. No one was – I mean, not just counter-organizing. No one was even, you know, documenting it. We went into some local communities, and certain individuals knew about it, but they weren't even producing research about it. And obviously, a group on the national level isn't going to go in and pick out which county commission members – have ties to the militias. You couldn't possibly do that in every county in the U.S. That has to be done locally. And we were able to have some successes with this. We helped our information helped defeat candidates. It helped expose and break links between militias and people who already were elected. You know, it mobilized people to push back against them who before that had been afraid to or didn't really know what they were dealing with. You know, we gave them a framework to do this and hooked them in with some, you know, activist resources. And it did actually help some to deal with this. And nothing was being done about it otherwise. So, you know, that was a really an odd situation.
So the next thing that I want to ask you is, you know, people who are not familiar with anti-racism work, anti-fascism work, who maybe have only, I feel like the term Antifa like rose into the public consciousness just a few years ago, and now it's, you know, on the national stage, at least the Republican one. You know, what do you think, you know, some misconceptions about anti-racist work or anti-fascist work is? You know, it's kind of the, you know, Fox News likes to loop footage of, you know, people next to trash cans on fire and stuff like that. It's my understanding from having seen this in person and whatnot, that is anything but a complete picture. But what do you think some sort of the misconceptions around this type of organizing are?
There's so many of them at this point. It's hard to it's hard to address it. I mean, the what's been called Antifa by Mr. Trump has almost no relationship to the work that's done. It's become a catch term for all different kinds of activists. Now you're seeing Antifa BLM next to each other as if they're somehow the same thing. It's taken it's being cast in the classic conspiratorial narrative as this sort of subversive agent that's doing all these things, same things that the Jews did in Nazi Germany in the 30s, that the Illuminati did in other periods, that the communists did in the 50s. In fact, I believe that a lot of the talking points used about Antifa and the way that it got developed, the anti-Antifa stuff, is based on earlier anti-communist stuff. And you'll even see this, oh, Antifa are, you know, Stalinists and stuff. Well, I mean, most actual Antifa activists are anarchists and not Stalinists at all. So it's this kind of odd. So it's just talking about things largely that doesn't exist. Most Antifa work, I'm going to be honest with you, the guide is basically 95% of Antifa work is legal and nonviolent. And that's what this guide is. It is the 95% of stuff that's legal and nonviolent. You know, some Antifa activists will do direct confrontation with various far right people. And, you know, that's a very small part of things. Do people set trash on fire sometimes? Yeah, it occasionally happens, but, you know, it's almost like there's an illusion that there's no radical left in the United States. This is a funny thing. A number of years ago, some Republican claimed there were 30 socialists in Congress. And some people, some Democrats were like, oh, this is red baiting. And I was like, well, 30 Democratic socialists? I hope there are. There's like hundreds and hundreds, you know, how many senators and representatives? 550 or something? So like, well, I would hope there's 30 Democratic socialists by any name. There's this illusion that there isn't a radical left in the U.S. There always has been. There has been for, you know, there have been anarchists in the U.S. for 140 years. Yeah, people do set trash cans on fire sometimes in certain cities. And, you know, you can always just take a, you know, crop that out and blow it up into a huge thing. And you can do that if you want. You know, conspiracy theories are usually based on a kernel of truth. And so if you want to say, you know, Antifa is a subversive agent that's destroying the cities, your kernel might be a single trash can on fire, you know, and then you can use that to point to it. So I'm not sure what can be done about that at this point. It's almost like the cat's out of the bag and the illusion is floating around. The talking points are floating around. They have almost nothing to do with the movement itself. You know, I don't even know who's really Antifa these days. I mean, who, you know, most of these conflicts are limited to Portland, Oregon, with some in Seattle and very occasionally other places. And I mean, these people who show up in the streets, they're just progressive and anti-racist protesters. I'm not sure that they're, you know, they get called Antifa and maybe Antifa groups did call the demonstration, but the individuals who show up are just, you know, likely the same individuals who show up to any kind of progressive demonstration. So it's very strange because there's so little truth to all of the wild talking points. It's hard to even map, you know, they don't even map on each other.
Right. And I think this is, you know, an interesting guide because I can at least imagine in my head a situation where somebody is, you know, maybe scared of these far right groups. They don't want to go out and do these street demonstrations. They are worried that they will wind up in the next, you know, viral Antifa trash can video, standing next to it, staring at it, and get doxxed out or something. I don't know. You know, so a lot of this guide is super interesting because it is stuff, like you said, you can do from home. And if you take, you know, some efforts to maybe conceal your identity or whatever online, whether you choose to do that or not, this is, you know, stuff that seemingly anyone could do. Is there a piece, this is a terrible question, but I'm going to try it anyway. Is there a piece on the list of 40 that you think is like most crucial, most effective, or is it more of a broad package thing?
You know, it is a whole package. Like, I think, you know, the best thing to be done, and there are people who do this, many people who do this, so it takes some skill to get involved, and there's a division of labor. But, you know, figuring out who the far right, who especially violent far right activists are in your community and exposing them is by far the most effective tool. Legal or not, it is legal, the most effective tool that we have to counter the far right. They hate being doxxed. They do not want their neighbors to know that they're going around beating people up. Even conservatives, even, you know, Trump voting conservatives in most communities frown upon people using violence against their political opponents. They do not like that. I'm not saying everyone, but most of them do not like that, and they will draw a line at it. And so if you have violent far-right activists, figuring out who they are and exposing them is by far the single most important thing that can be done. But again, like we talked about earlier, this is not this whole process. It's a long process, and it's not just like one or two tactical things that you do. There's a learning curve to do it. There's support you have to provide to other people. And we didn't talk much about this. You know, when you start working with these people and you identify them, ultimately, you know, you can dox them and you can get them fired and you can have, you know, the local corner store refuse to serve them, but they won't go away as activists. Even if they get arrested, sometimes they then, you know, spread propaganda in the jail systems and come out even more hardened. The only way you can really get rid of them is for them to abandon their views. And so this is also part of this holistic thing, is that we really encourage people to the extent is encourage people to leave these movements, encourage them to get into exit programs run by former extremists, and to go through a process of exiting their movement. Like that's actually the ultimate goal of all of this work to me, is to get people who are fascists to become former fascists. And I know a number of them. It's funny, it's the girlfriend of the big Nazi skinhead organizer. I grew up in a small town called Lawrenceville, Georgia, outside of Atlanta during the big Klan and Nazi revival in the 80s and 90s. And the girlfriend of the main Nazi skinhead organizer, Shannon Martinez, is where I grew up, is now a former and works with a lot of people to help them get out of these movements. So, you know, I talk a lot and try to, you know, help out Shannon and Joshua Bates and other formers. You'll find them on Twitter often. I often find these people on Twitter and help them to what extent I can. They're often the best placed people to help people coming out of the movements, because they know what they've gone through and they know all the challenges they face. Because people who leave these movements face a lot of challenges too, and they also need support. A lot of people don't like doing that. Some people think once somebody's been in these movements, they're like toxic forever. But I think that's a really politically a mistaken way to look at it. We really do need to help these people get out, because we don't want them to go back in. There's recidivism once people leave this stuff. That's the only way to deflate these movements, is to get people to leave them.
Right, and that's not to say that, you know, a skinhead will be de-radicalized, then turn around and then like join hands in a Black Lives Matter protest or something, you know. But the goal is to get them out of a violent hate movement, because like that's the threat here.
Yeah, I mean, some of them do move to the left and join these things, but I don't even encourage them to do that. I mean, they should become stamp collectors or whatever. You know? I just want them to leave. That's it. Then it's good.
So as we're starting to, mark our descent towards the end of the show, I'm curious, you know, as somebody who has experience, you know, witnessing this stuff firsthand in a lot of cases, kind of your thoughts on the current political moment that we're in. I get inquiries from people all day who are, you know, see something in the news, going on with the far right, and they're very worried, and they're asking me what they should do. And I, you know, my go-to response has always been like, well, we need more people keeping eyes on this stuff. Can you keep eyes on this stuff? And this guide, I think, you know, that you produce is a hell of a lot better answer than I ever gave anybody. I'm curious your thoughts on the political moment. How worried should we be? Having seen a little bit of everything in your time doing this kind of work, sort of how does this compare maybe to other political moments? I'm curious just kind of your broader perspective on things.
Yeah, I'm always the bearer of bad news, and that's certainly going to be the case in this instance. I think so. What's happening, and what's happened over the last 5 years really, is that there's a violent far-right fringe that has, you know, that's always been here but has exploded as part of, you know, the right wing of the Trumpist movement, right? I mean, I think Trump is far right, but he's like a rather mild far rightist. What's in the guide is about how to mitigate the damage that is wrought by the most radical people. And that can, and I think largely must be done on a local grassroots level. I mean, there's some other things like lawsuits that help and stuff, but the problem is that these tactics aren't going to change the national political situation. And a lot is out of our individuals' hands with the election. You know, I mean, my real fear is that Trump is going to lose and refuse to step down. And then that will truly be a shit show. And that's going to be decided in some ways by what the GOP does, by what the police do, and by what the army does. You know, I do think that is absolutely a real possibility. And I've never been one of the I've always been a little against the Trump hysteria. You know, I've always argued that Trump's not a fascist. But, you know, you don't have to be a fascist to be an authoritarian. There's plenty of military juntas in the world. And, you know, he's an unethical demagogue, and he's going to get away with what he thinks he can. So I am worried, you know, about what would happen in that situation. I am worried about there being existent far right groups going on some kind of rampage around this and attacking people. And again, because if people aren't already armed and people aren't already ready, I don't think people are going to get ready in the next,
like, 2 months or something.
7 weeks, less. So I'm a little worried, you know, if the militias somehow are mobilized to, I don't know, stop voting booths. I mean, there's just so many possible scenarios. Like, I don't think they're going to happen. I don't think there's going to be a, you know, people ask me about civil war. I don't think there's going to be a civil war, anything, certainly not in the immediate future. But yeah, that's my real worry, is that Trump will lose and refuse to step down and that's going to unleash around that an orgy of violence.
I share many of those exact concerns. You know, what happens on the national scale will be one thing, but I worry because, you know, some of the rhetoric we've been tracking at Right Wing Watch, you know, from various media figures are saying, you know, if, you know, Trump better do something because we have this army of patriots ready to go. You know, we all have guns, we all have whatever, and like, especially like QAnon stuff with, you know, extremist stuff, absolutely, militia stuff, absolutely, you know, all these people have kind of been primed to be ready in case this election is quote unquote stolen. And I think that is where, for better or for worse, the rubber is going to hit the road, you know.
You know, it's so hard, especially, I'm sure you can share this concern, is that you hear this rhetoric from them all the time.
Right.
Like, people came to me and they're like, oh, Stuart Rhodes said he's ready for civil war. I'm like, Stuart Rhodes has been saying, you know, civil war is going to happen for years and years and years. Like, it's hard to tell when to take it seriously. I do believe it's a much more higher chance now that they will actually act on this, and not just a few individuals will act on it, but it will be acted on in mass. I'm not convinced that will happen, but it's possible. And I think in some ways this is going to rely on the center-right response. Like, will local officials be like, hey, we like Trumpian rhetoric, but we're still a democratic republic. You know, we're still a nation of laws, and we're governed by a constitution, and we're not going to let mobs come and intimidate people, or not. And, you know, I think at this point, people might want to be, you know, making plans for what happens in these, potential situations, like, and talking with elected officials and others, like, what will you do? Are you going to defend us if, you know, mass far-right vigilante action happens? What is the plan for that? You know,
that was some bad news. So let's wrap things up with something fun. This is Shitpost. So the last question, you know, it's always meant to introduce some levity. I feel like a lot of interviews on this show, just given the topic matter, end up with me and the guest, you know, looking at each other through Skype and just being like, oh man, I swear, you know, what's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Well, I'm not sure this is going to be any happier, but I have been really, so all this Antifa stuff, the crazy Antifa conspiracy theories, I love them. I mean, I'm totally scared by them, but I love reading them. I love it when I work, some of them, sometimes they work me into them and stuff. You know, they're hilarious. The Antifa bus stuff is hilarious. So the most recent thing, as people have probably heard out west, where there's all the forest fires, these rumors going through Oregon in particular, that Antifa is setting them. And so it came out that a Curry County commissioner actually was repeating this stuff. I mean, it's one thing for individuals and far-right individuals to do stuff, and even police, because the police generally have pretty far-right views. But, like, having elected officials come out that are doing this, like, I actually find it hilarious. I mean, it's totally dangerous. I mean, they're probably killing some of their constituents by encouraging them to stay and, you know, guard for looters or harassing people fleeing. You know, I mean, they're hampering evacuation efforts, but there's something just hilarious about a county commissioner being like, Antifa's coming to my, like, rural Oregon county to go set fires to things.
I'm now imagining, like, some meeting of elected officials, and, like, the county commissioner rolls up, has a manila folder. He jostles the folder lightly. A couple pieces of paper fall out on his table. There's Facebook posts from Sally Mae Jane, Super Patriot 72.
And WorldNet Daily printouts.
Right.
It happens. It happens in some of these places.
Right. It's, you know, like you said, it's totally terrifying, but it's one of those situations where it is just so absurd and I think objectively hilarious. I just wish it wasn't so dangerous, right?
I have this reoccurring, like, fantasy nightmare that someone's going to, like, come and kill me and, like, say all this crazy Antifa stuff, and I'm just going to start laughing at them and be like, that's totally preposterous, and then they're going to shoot me. But I'll still laugh in their face.
I mean, it's also the thing. Sometimes you just have to laugh so you don't cry, you know?
Well, I think this work is kind of like, you know, people like to watch train wrecks and watch fires. And I think this work in general is something like that. You're just like, watch the worst people saying the craziest, most horrific things, and you just keep doing it. So there's some kind of fascination about staring at really some of the worst right. things in our society.
Well, I think that is a good place to wrap it up. Spencer, where can people find your work online? Like I said, the guide, I'm going to put a link down in the description. Go check it out if you're interested in learning more and checking, you know, reading further. But Spencer, where can people find yourself?
All my stuff is linked to on my website, spencersunshine.com. The guide is up there. The guide is free, by the way. The text is there. There's printable PDFs. It's spencersunshine.com/40ways, FORTYWAYS. And I'm on Twitter at transform6789. Do the usual Twitter stuff, except I try not to get in arguments with people. Keeps me sane. So yeah, and you know, all the other things. But go to my website if you want. I have lists of all my writings from the last 15 years or so, if you want to learn more about the far right.
All right. Well, Spencer, thanks so much for joining Shitpost, and we'll talk to you next time.
Great to be on the show.